This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sea level will go up all during your lifetime and long, long after. The effects will be profound. In this show, the grand old man of coastal science, Dr. Oren Pilkey, warns, start withdrawing from the coastline now or wait for the coming panic. Risk expert Bill McGuire explains how more water in the seas can trigger earthquakes and tsunamis. NOAA scientist Richard Feely talks ocean acidification. I'm Alex. Welcome to the second Radio EcoShock program on rising seas. As the world warms, humans will have to move back from the ocean, cities and all. Oren H. Pilkey wrote a book on it, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. In North Carolina, he is the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences. Dr. Pilkey published over 250 works and 45 books. Duke University named a building after him, and I hope Dr. Pilkey will not mind if I called him the granddaddy of coastal science. From Durham, North Carolina, Oren Pilkey, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So over the past centuries, Americans did move massively from the interior to the coast, and that's where we find fabulously priced real estate and movies about seaside bliss. Are you really sure that is going away, whether we like it or not?
I think there's not the slightest doubt that it's going away, primarily because of sea level rise. A second factor is the expected intensification, a factor that works here, at least on the southeastern U.S., an intensification of hurricanes. This, in the last 2 years, we've had 18 storms, hurricanes, North Atlantic hurricanes. That's not unusual, but what is unusual, we had 5 of those 18 were really big storms causing a lot of damage. And I think that's the beginning of the expected intensification of storms based on the warming of the ocean.
Yes, it's true. A single giant storm can practically rewrite the coastline.
That's for sure. The biggest disaster in those storms was Puerto Rico, where the storm, a Category 4 storm, almost Category 5, just crossed the whole island. It was really a disaster. And it killed, they have estimated, more than 2,000 people. A real disaster if ever there was one.
Didn't a storm turn you toward your lifetime work?
Yes, as a matter of fact, my parents retired in Waveland, Mississippi, right at a house that was an elevation of 13 feet. And they had Hurricane Camille in 1969 that came through. Now, Hurricane Camille was one of the biggest ever to hit the U.S., not the biggest, but the most intense. 200-mile-an-hour winds were actually recorded on land, and their house was severely damaged. The house then disappeared completely in Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Anyhow, my brother and I went down to Waveland, Mississippi to help the parents, and I was so impressed with the power of nature at the shoreline. I hadn't even thought about it. At this time, I was more of an oceanographer going to sea. This basically turned me into, shall we say, a shallow water person rather than a deep water person. It was so impressive. It's just hard to describe.
Apparently, millions of us humans think we can fix this, maybe with new sand dunes or floating stilt homes or some technology. Can we fix it, really?
In my opinion, we cannot fix it. We can do something. Building a seawall, which will destroy the beach, but building a seawall will sometimes offer shelter for an intermediate storm, but not a big storm. We can pump up sand on the beach, which we call beach replenishment. That does stop some damage because the storm concentrates on taking away the sand, rather than taking away the house. But basically, in a time of rising sea level, we simply cannot hold the shoreline still. Most of our efforts are to hold the shoreline still, and the shoreline wants to move back because of the sea level rise.
Did North Carolina actually pass a law against predictions of rising seas like yours?
Well, they almost said that. They didn't quite say it that way, but that's the way it kind of came out in the media, and it wasn't far from that. North Carolina in 1985 passed the first regulation prohibiting seawalls, which was a giant step forward. I was very proud of them. And because the reason they prohibited seawalls is because they eventually destroy beaches. And, of course, beaches are critical to coastal living, especially in a coast like ours, which has a lot of tourists and so forth. But they somehow changed administrations, and there was a lot of resistance to the idea that you couldn't build a seawall and so forth. They decided, instead of looking at a sea level rise of 3 feet or so, which is what most communities are looking at, they decided to look at a sea level rise of in the next 30 years, which was 8 inches. In effect, they said, we'll ignore sea level rise. And in fact, the way it was interpreted often was they made sea level rise illegal, which in effect they actually did. It was really irresponsible and even stupid in the context of what we know is going to what we know is happening right now.
In 2012, right after Hurricane Sandy, I spoke with Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland, and we talked about surge defenses in cities around the world. So let's talk about some of the great cities of the American South. Can cities there successfully retreat from the shoreline, and will they have time to do so?
Actually, each city is different. Each city is different, has a different problem. Miami has the worst problem because Miami is situated on top of a thick 20 to 75 foot thick limestone that is extremely porous. And to give you an idea of what that means, a small pond within the city of Miami actually show tides. Maybe just an inch or even less than that, but tides that correspond with the offshore tide. This means that, in effect, Miami is really sitting in the water. They can't build seawalls to help them. They can't build levees or dikes. So I anticipate that Miami will have to be completely abandoned within this century, probably within 50 years or so. New Orleans is a different situation. New Orleans is fine until the inevitable Hurricane Camille type, a very strong hurricane, comes by and floods the city again. I anticipate that at some unknown time, New Orleans will also have to go away for sure. Wilmington, North Carolina, which is flooding quite a bit right now due to the so-called nuisance tides. These are high tides that come around as a result of, they're really the old spring tide, but they're higher now because of sea level rise. Anyhow, Wilmington is another city that's quite low. And, you know, sometimes portions of the city are quite high in it and are not going to be impacted by sea level rise directly. But if the surrounding area is flooded, which is often the case, the roads coming to the higher areas are flooded. And so you can't go to grocery stores, can't go to schools, churches, and so forth. So you can't just look at the amount of flooding from, let's say, a 3 foot sea level rise. You have to consider the whole big picture of what that does to transportation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, of the big projects that people around the world have invested in right by the ocean. Boston's Big Dig, the new tunnel in downtown Seattle, or the airport built out on the sea like Japan's Kansai International Airport. We're investing trillions of dollars of social wealth in these projects as though you never wrote your books and papers, as though the scientists around the world have never warned. That's a bad idea.
Yeah. It's hard to deal with the city's problem, you know. But I think we can learn something from the Dutch. The Dutch, now, they're not like the United States. They're a very small country. There's no place to move to. A good part of the country is below sea level. They're building big, big, huge dunes along the shoreline, and which they kind of have to. Remember, they're in a different situation than we are. And they're doing things like designating parks and parking lot parking areas as to be flooded. One big park in Holland actually has tennis courts and soccer fields and swimming pools. And the whole reason that park exists, it's a place to be flooded in the case of a big storm. And, of course, they're also putting they put a big gate across at Rotterdam across the mouth of the estuary, a 70-foot-high wall that will move back and forth. That they can do because they have to, and it's a wealthy, well-educated country. But for us, we don't have that privilege. We're going to have to, in our cities like New York, have a lot of pretty good elevation, although 40,000 people in New York City live at elevation below 3 feet. All those and a lot of others will have to move somewhere. Boston can temporarily solve its problem by building a massive seawall around the front of the city. Boston is in large part made up of very low elevation, pumped up mud from Boston Harbor. All of downtown Boston is very low and very vulnerable. But they can, unlike Miami, they can protect themselves for a while with a big seawall. But if the sea level rise goes up to as much as 6 feet, which is some people think it's getting up that way because of increased melting of the Antarctic ice sheet, then Boston, especially during a storm, is going to be in very serious trouble. So each city is different. Some cities are more protectable, so we say, than others. There is no coastal city that is not going to be severely impacted. And, of course, all the ports and harbors of the world, all the docks are going to have to be raised. And, of course, that makes a big problem for commerce, for the military, too.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people about the situation of the U.S. Navy and the Coast Guard and where their bases are and how much they're already flooding, some of them. You know, we tend to pay attention when cities flood, but not when damaged coasts kind of collapse into the sea. Erosion on the coast isn't news, but should it be, Orrin Pilkey?
Oh, absolutely. We, in the U.S., we have 3,000 miles of barrier islands. These are the most vulnerable major coastal environment there is. And it's a huge thing economically, of course, with all the tourist industry. In the state of Florida, in a recent study there, they're looking at the population of people, of Americans who live below 3 feet in elevation. New York was number one. 49,000 people live below 3 feet in elevation. But of the 25 cities that they looked at, 20 of them were in Florida. So Florida is in really bad shape, potentially. And their governor, who has now been elected to be their senator, does not believe in global climate change. That doesn't help the situation. We should be making plans. You know, I've talked about all the evacuation that's going to happen. One problem we see is that there's nobody planning on that evacuation. Where are 4 million people? That's the number expected from Miami. Where are 4 million people going to go? As you pointed out, we've had a lot of evacuations in the past, like our Dust Bowl in the 20s, and after World War II, a massive movement of people from the south to the north. But those were individuals who just went one at a time and so forth. But now we're thinking about 4 million people who are probably going to move in a relatively short period of time. We're going to do some planning.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from North Carolina. My guest is the well-known expert on how shorelines work, Dr. Orrin H. Pilkey. We're talking about the inevitable march of the sea into the land that we thought was ours as the world warms. Well, you raised a really great point there, because when we talk about rising seas, too many Americans think it will strike islands in the South Pacific or Bangladesh. But there was a recent study in Nature Climate Change. It was published in March 2016, titled Millions Projected to Be at Risk from Sea Level Rise in the Continental United States. And they project that, as you say, with more intense storms and the rising seas, we will see a movement of people not seen in the United States since the Great Migration from the South during the last century. This is going to be startling news for the next generation or two, I think.
boy, oh boy, look, I'm just thinking, I often think about my grandchildren and what they're going to be facing and what their children are going to be facing. It's really going to be a major shakeup of this country, for sure, and all over the world as well. The three places that are which are going to be flooded most intensely and will produce the most refugees, one is South Florida, particularly Miami. Two, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach and so forth, Daytona Beach. Then the second one is the Mississippi Delta, where there are about 2 million people who are expected to be fairly quickly displaced by sea level rise, meaning probably within this century or maybe just a little past the end of this century that they will have to get out of there. And a third place, third large area that's going to be flooded but doesn't have too much population is what we call the Inner Banks, which is a large, flat, swampy area behind the Outer Banks of North Carolina and partly in Virginia. There are probably less than 1 million people, but that whole area will be flooded.
And we're also talking about coastlines in, well, the city of Sydney and Shanghai and parts of Vancouver will be lost. And it's a long shopping list around the world. This is going to be a global change for the coming generations, I think.
It most certainly is. It most certainly is a global problem. In our book, we concentrated primarily on the U.S., but, boy, some of the stories coming out of Bangladesh, for example, you know, when they get a big hurricane, the numbers of people who are missing or killed are 100,000 or so. And what they have done, by the way, is pretty interesting. People can't really escape. The road system isn't good enough. Not everybody doesn't have a car and so forth and so on. So they have built a series of shelters, very substantially built shelters that can withstand winds and are high enough off the ground with stilts and so forth that they will not be impacted by a hurricane. And so people can rush to their nearest shelter and crowd in there while the storm is going on. It's something that could be used here, too. We have a real problem with people escaping from our cities in Charleston, South Carolina, and in the Mississippi Delta. Here we've had storms come by which people tried to get away, like in Katrina, tried to get away, and they ended up being jammed on the highway with, and in the case of Charleston, they had a four-lane interstate coming into the city, but they kept two of those lanes open for, quote, emergency vehicles. So everybody in Charleston who wanted to escape had to go out the two lanes. And it seems so strange to see these photographs of the two lanes which are jammed because of accidents and so forth. People ran out of gas. And on the other two lanes, there's nobody, not a thing going on. And that we've got to do some more planning, some better planning on evacuation. And I think we learned some lessons from the fires in California recently, where they had pretty good plans for that city of paradise and of escape routes, but then three of the four escape routes were covered by smoke and were impassable. It's a different situation, of course, but it's the same kind of problem. To get people away during emergencies needs some more planning. We really need to work on that.
So facing an unstoppable ocean over time, can you expand further on what you mean by walk away methodically? What should happen? What could happen?
What I'm saying is we should be retreating now. We should not wait until the wolf is at the door. We should be moving now. For example, every time a storm occurs on any shoreline anywhere, we should not replace that building. Buildings that are damaged should not be replaced. That's one possible way to begin retreating. And others, we're just going to have to start moving back, and we can do it in a planned fashion, I think. It will be expensive, and it will be painful. But if we don't do that, then in 30, 40, 50 years, we will move back, whether we like it or not. But we'll move back in what I call tactical disarray. It'll be even more costly, and it'll be a mess. Everybody's moving right now quickly, so let's do it now.
We got to change our whole idea of insurance, too. The private industry bailed on insuring a lot of coastal properties. I thought that might discourage people. But no, the states, governments rushed in with their own insurance, backed by all of us taxpayers. At some point, we've got to give up on insuring people and paying them to rebuild just where they were already wiped out by the sea.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yes, that's exactly the point. And the insurance, we have federal flood insurance, among other types of insurance, and that is, I think, $12 billion in the red. We should raise insurance premiums to the point that they will pay for the risk. As it is, the public pays for the risk because the insurance is not sufficient. The premiums are not sufficient to pay for the damage. If that happens, the cost of living near the shore would raise instantly, very quickly, and it would discourage a lot of development. Discourage of near-shore development is a good thing.
From a scientist's perspective, does it matter whether the President of the United States believes in rising seas?
Yeah, that's the most difficult question. I guess it's not difficult. In fact, it matters a lot. The thing is most distressing of all is not only does he not believe in global climate change, but we are actively working against global climate change. We're actually taking moves that will favor increased rates of climate change, such as putting tariffs on solar panels, changing the mileage requirements on cars, and so forth and so on. So many ways that we are actually making the problem worse. So it does make a big difference. And I think we have been in the past, at least, a leader. We've taken international leadership here and trying to fight, make moves against global climate change. But, boy, that has gone away completely now.
In 2016, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Australia's Charlie Varan, and it was heartbreaking. He explored and he documented the coral world that he loved, and now he's charting its demise. As one of the great educators about the coast, I think you were in the same position. True?
Well, yes. I have been there from the beginning, so to speak, because I'm an old man now. And then I can remember when 30, 40 years ago, when it was radical to say things like we can't build seawalls if you're going to destroy the beaches, and we've got to plan retreat. I am so pleased that that is no longer a radical thought, but there was a long time there where it was so discouraging, and I took a lot of heat, to put it mildly. In one small town in South Carolina, the city council passed a resolution saying that I was no longer welcome to come there. But at any rate, that's part of the game, and I kind of recognize that in a way that attitude was a sign that I was actually having some impact.
Well, the sea will pass a motion saying that the people in that little town will no longer be welcome there as the tides keep coming in, I suppose. Now, Oren, I know you have talented children. They have co-authored and even illustrated some of your books. But now, as you and I start to get kind of oldish, what can we tell our grandchildren, or should we tell them at all?
Oh, I think we should tell them. I think we would want our grandchildren to be really aware of the situation. And every individual has opportunities to make the point in your breakfast table conversations about if we're going to get a car, Dad, why don't we get a car with low mileage? We don't want any of those big cars, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, I think everybody needs to be educated. And my grandchildren or our grandchildren will certainly vote someday, too. In fact, one of mine is already voting. And he, I think, is voting in the right way, as far by my definition. Well, I think education is so important. And look, we wouldn't have a president of the type that we have if he had been educated in his younger days, if he was aware. People need to understand about science. We need to understand how science works. You know, science works by criticism, and often statements made about climate change by one person or another are criticized, like somebody recently, Jim Hansen, the guy who informed the Congress in 1988 that the sea level was rising. Well, he says the sea level could rise as much as 10 feet by 2100. Well, he's gotten a lot of criticism for that, but that's okay. Don't throw out his opinion just because it's criticized. Remember, that's an opinion. That's one endpoint. Maybe it will. Probably it won't. But what I have found, besides learning facts about global climate change, it's also important to understand science and scientists and how we work.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you like this. This is a marvelous opportunity for me. And I hope that people living near the coast now will think about taking moves now, be planning now for movement, for moving your house. And if you're going down to near the coast, if you want to build, you want a house that's near the sea, you got to remember, if you can see the sea can see you, and act accordingly and make your choices in the context of the science of global climate change that is going to impact in so many ways on all of us.
We have been talking with Duke University Professor Emeritus Orrin Pilkey. From his vast record of publishing on The Way the Coastline Works, I'm working with his book, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Orrin, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, for sure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to the best of Radio EcoShock interviews on rising seas.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From Japan and then Ecuador, when major earthquakes strike, the media rush to Dr. William McGuire. He's a volcanologist and world-known specialist in extreme geologic events. McGuire is Emeritus Professor of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at University College London. Bill has advised the UK government on global threats and appears often on TV. Bill was also an author of the 2011 report of the IPCC regarding extreme events. His latest book is Waking the Giant: How a Changing Climate Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. Bill, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What is your recent take on the big quakes in Japan and Ecuador?
Well, to be honest, it's really just business as usual. I mean, these are not gigantic quakes. We would expect up to a dozen of earthquakes of this sort of size every year. So it's really nothing unusual. I mean, you see stress and strain accumulating on faults all over the planet all the time. And periodically, that results in a fault rupturing and an earthquake of this sort of size.
Are we entering a more intense geologic period, or do we just have better reporting and more cell phone videos?
Well, that's the thing these days, isn't it, that disasters and disastrous events are in the news sort of immediately. Everybody, none of these things can happen without people seeing them or filming them these days. We do have a variation in the numbers of earthquakes that happen every year and the number of volcanic eruptions that happen every year. But it's within the statistical noise, if you like. There's no, not yet anyway, there's no obvious increase in either volcanic activity or earthquake activity. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our changing environment, that climate change isn't triggering certain events. It's just that we're not sure which ones those are and we can't detect them against the general background of activity.
Right. You did put in your book, Waking the Giant, that climate change could possibly stimulate more activity from volcanoes. I have a hard time understanding how that's possible. How does it work?
Well, it's something that we've known for a long time by looking back in time. And it's there are a number of ways this can happen. One of them is where you have volcanoes that are loaded by a great thickness of ice. You have in Iceland today, and as you had right across Iceland, for example, in the past, when that load of ice melts, when it's removed, magma that's been unable to get out when the ice was sitting there can get out more easily. Also, if you take the weight of the ice away, you actually produce more magma underneath the crust in the Earth's mantle as well. That's one way we can do it. We can also do it in the case of volcanoes that are coastally located or form islands by changing sea level. If you change sea level dramatically, either up or down, then it creates quite big changes in stress and strain in the crust that can push magma out. So there's a number of ways this can happen.
What about the melting of ice, say, in Iceland that seems to be capping over some volcanoes?
Well, that is a big concern. If we go back something like 12,000 years, or go back 20,000 years, the height of the last ice age, Iceland was covered by a kilometre of ice, and that weight stopped virtually all volcanic activity. But when the ice melted, around about 12,000 years ago, there was almost a real what's called a volcano storm. The rate of volcanic activity went up 50 times over a course of about 1,500 years. Now, Iceland isn't covered by a kilometre of ice today, but there is this big ice cap, the Vatnajökull ice cap in the east, and that is melting very, very rapidly. And modelling that's been undertaken suggests that as that melts, so we will see an increase in the amount of lava coming out and also in the amount of lava that's being produced underneath the crust. So, I mean, it's certain for a start that ice cap will melt because of the rate of temperatures rising. And we will see a measurable increase in volcanic activity. And we know, obviously, from the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010, that just one moderate eruption on Iceland can create total chaos across the aviation industry.
And here is the question everyone asks you. Bill McGuire, do you think climate change is a contributing cause to the recent great quakes from Nepal to Japan?
Well, that's an interesting question. In terms of the Japanese earthquake, there was a recent Japanese earthquake and the one in Ecuador, there's no particular reason why we should think climate change was involved in that. The same really goes for the Nepal earthquakes, although there is a climate mechanism for triggering earthquakes in the Nepal region. And it's only been really discovered quite recently that when you have monsoon rainfall, that monsoon rainfall soaks into the sediment in the Ganges Plain right across the front of the Himalayas, and it compresses the faults there. And it seems that compression is causing more earthquakes to happen in the winter months along the Himalayan, what we call the Himalayan front, than the rest of the year. So if you have a change in the monsoon, for example, as a result of climate change, then you may see some change in the controlling of earthquakes in the Himalayas. But the Nepal earthquake, the specific earthquake that happened in April last year, we don't have any direct evidence for a climate link. But then again, as I said, we may not necessarily see that.
You know, people are concerned with climate change, and we should be, but some of us have a hard time believing these latest quakes are not. Everything has to be connected to climate. But there must be a point where your theory does really kick in earnest. Do we know when that might be?
The thing is, all different faults that generate earthquakes right across the planet will be in different states of stress and strain. Some will be ready to go, ready to rupture, ready to generate big earthquakes. Others might have ruptured recently, and they may take centuries to accumulate enough strain to rupture again. Now, in terms of climate change, in terms of the stress and strain induced by the loss of ice, by rising sea levels, the faults that are going to be affected are those ones that are critically poised and ready to rupture to generate an earthquake. And all that's needed there is literally the pressure of a handshake to set those off. So those faults that are ready to go are the ones that are going to be affected. Now, we may not see an increase in the total number of earthquakes across the world, but you only need one or two major faults in built-up areas and urban areas that are ready to go. Only a few of those faults to be triggered by climate change, and you will have a massive impact.
What caused that great quake and tsunami off the coast of Japan in 2011?
That was simply tectonic stresses. In other words, the world's tectonic plates pushing against one another, accumulating stress and strain over a long period of time, and then rupturing, as they do every few hundred years in most cases, and generating a big tsunami. I mean, that earthquake was a submarine earthquake. Now, if you think about one of the triggers for earthquakes relating to climate change, is to do with sea level. But in those cases, as sea level goes up and the load of the water increases and increases, it will stabilize those submarine faults. They will tend to rupture probably less often. The faults that we should worry about are faults like the San Andreas that are parallel to a coastline, because where sea level rises there, next to those faults, it will bend them. It will bend one side of the fault and not the other, and that can allow them to move more easily. So we shouldn't be too concerned about submarine faults, but we should be a lot more concerned about faults that run across the land parallel to the ocean.
But I think this is one really important point you make, Bill. Because of tsunamis, listeners do not have to live in an earthquake zone themselves to suffer the consequences. Could you tell us about another couple of tsunamis, either in human history or the geologic record?
Well, extraordinarily, we've had two catastrophic tsunamis, as I'm sure all your listeners will know, the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 and then Japan in 2011. That's really unprecedented to see them occur so frequently. But if we go back in the past, there's evidence of massive tsunamis right across the planet, not just in the Pacific. I think one of the most interesting formed about 8,000 years ago as a result of climate change, because after the ice sheets that covered Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden, started to melt, the crust underneath there started to bounce back up very, very rapidly because of the weight of the ice had disappeared. That triggered lots of big earthquakes. One of those big earthquakes triggered a gigantic landslide off the coast of Norway, one of the biggest known on the planet. That generated a tsunami which was up to 30 meters high in the north of Scotland. It came right down the North Sea into Western Europe, and it went straight across the Atlantic towards North America as well. Now, it's that sort of thing that we're worried about for the future, because Greenland is in a very similar situation to Scandinavia at the end of the last ice age. 2 or 3 kilometers of ice. That ice is melting already. The crust is already bouncing back up under Greenland. We know that from GPS measurements. If that uplift causes earthquakes, if those earthquakes trigger big submarine landslides, then we could see tsunamis in the North Atlantic again.
And there's a YouTube video where you introduce four major threats, and that's from another of your books, Global Catastrophe, a very short introduction. Could you just outline what those four threats are?
Yes, there's four really big natural threats, which I call global geophysical events, or GGs. There's the asteroid or comet impact. There's a volcanic super eruption. There's what I call a strategic earthquake, an earthquake that occurs somewhere that affects one of the big financial centers and therefore has a knock-on effect across the planet in terms of employment and jobs and economy and politics and this sort of thing. Tokyo is really the place I think of when I talk about that. And then the fourth one is a giant ocean-wide tsunami, particularly in the North Atlantic. And obviously the place I've been working for some time now is on the Canary Island of La Palma, where you have this huge mass of rock which is unstable and at some point in the future will collapse into the North Atlantic and generate a major tsunami. Now, that could threaten tens of millions of people around the margins of the Atlantic in North America and also in Europe. So those are the four things, really: super eruption, asteroid or comet impact, giant tsunami, and strategic earthquake.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Bill McGuire. He's the well-known UK expert on extreme geophysical hazards like earthquakes and volcanoes and even climate change. Yeah, you've talked about Tokyo as a city waiting to die. That's pretty extreme talk. Tell us more.
Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, not literally, I don't think. But Tokyo is in one of the most seismically active parts of the planet. In the 1920s, there was a catastrophic earthquake there which killed maybe up to 200,000 people. The fires after the earthquake wiped out much of the city. Now, today, Tokyo's population is several times bigger than that. It's something like 36 million people, extraordinary size. It's one of the major economic and financial centers on the planet. The big earthquake in 2011 in Japan actually stressed some of the faults that might affect Tokyo in the future and brought forward the timing of the next large earthquake to affect Tokyo. So it is sitting there on a number of big faults which are pretty much ready to go. There are a huge number of people. Many of the buildings are well constructed and will withstand the earthquake, but there are over 1 million wooden buildings as well, which burn very, very easily and which can trigger, again, some of these huge fires that caused problems in the 1920s quake. So it is a big worry, certainly.
You know, I've got a quote here, Bill, from a not always reliable source. I'd like to check it with you. It says, scientists at Tokyo University estimate there is a 98% chance that in the next 30 years, Japan will be hit by an earthquake equivalent to that great Kanto of 1923. Seismologists at the Japan Meteorological Agency, however, put the odds of this happening at 70%. Does that sound about right to you?
It does, yes. You know, whether you're talking 70 or 90, that is a very, very high percentage in the next couple of decades. And it really illustrates the point that I think along with Istanbul in Turkey, Tokyo is one of the two most threatened cities in terms of a coming big earthquake.
And our financial system sometimes seems like a house of cards. It wouldn't take too much for one of these big cities to go down, even if it was Los Angeles, and then the whole world economy could be damaged.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the global economy ever since 1928 has really not recovered at all, and it's clearly on edge all the time. And one of these big earthquakes, one of these strategic earthquakes in the wrong place could just, as you point out, cause things to collapse like a house of cards. I mean, I get the impression that the stock markets and the currency markets are really just waiting for something to happen before they just fall apart.
And I've also talked with seismologists who are deeply worried about fault lines near nuclear power plants or the many reactors perched on the edge of the sea within tsunami range. Have you looked into that?
It's not an area that I look at in particular, but as a general point, the whole issue with nuclear power is that most power stations are coastally located. And at times of where we're going to see significant rise in sea level, that is not a good place to have these things. I mean, sea level could easily be 2 meters higher by the end of the century. In addition to that, the oceans are warming, and of course, reactors need cooling water, so they suffer if temperatures are much higher, if heat waves happen. Sometimes they have to be closed down, as has happened in the past. So, notwithstanding a specific tsunami threat from earthquakes, just rising sea levels is going to be a big problem for nuclear power plants that are on the coast.
Now, Bill McGuire, if you are advising a government on prioritizing spending, should it be on preparing for catastrophic geologic events, as we've been discussing, or to slash greenhouse gas emissions? What's your take?
I think it has to be climate change. We are in a dreadful situation, despite the Paris conference last December and all the backslapping and all the congratulations. I really don't think that's come up with anything firm whatsoever. Even if all the countries actually do what they say they're going to do in terms of reducing emissions, we've still got, in my opinion, and many other climate scientists, no chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change. So that has to be the priority. It really does. Things like asteroid impacts, things like super eruptions, these are certain to happen again. There's no doubt about that. But they have long return periods, 50,000 years with a super eruption, a 1 kilometer asteroid, maybe 500,000 years. So they will happen. We should be concerned about them. But climate change is here now. It's happening now. We must do something about it. We must take serious action now.
You know, I've lived for years in quake-prone cities like Vancouver and Los Angeles, and I experienced the deadly L.A. quake in 1971. But I have to say, for the average person just trying to pay the bills, is there anything we can do to prepare, or should we just go on about our lives hoping it doesn't happen?
Well, this is what we do, isn't it? This is what most people do, is go on about their lives hoping it won't happen to them or thinking it won't happen to them. It shouldn't really be down to individuals to concern themselves with these massive geological problems, things like super eruptions or asteroid impacts, whatever, because they are very infrequent. Even governments, although they need to pay attention to these, can't devote vast sums of money to trying to cope with them. What we need to do is to hope that we'll get warning signs. I mean, no volcano erupts without warning signs. We've spotted most of the big asteroids now, for example, out there, and we've got some good monitoring systems in place. So we would hope that we would see these things in time and be able to take measures then. But I don't want everybody to be locking themselves in a bunker with several hundred tins of baked beans or anything like that. And don't lose too much sleep over it, I would say.
What, it's safe for me to come out and not eat beans anymore?
Yes, I think beans is probably the wrong thing to have in a bunker in large quantities. But we can't afford to take this attitude to climate change. Climate change is absolutely critical, and it's the biggest threat to our race. If we burn all the fossil fuels or substantial proportion of fossil fuels, then the average temperature of our planet could be 30 degrees centigrade instead of what it is now, 14. Now, that physiologically, humans cannot exist under those conditions. That would see a mass dieback, a mass extinction of most of our race. And that's the bottom line.
Right. Have you got another book in the works or a TV series planned?
I've been thinking about this for a while, and I've sort of taken a slight change of tack, and I'm now working on a couple of fiction novels, young adult novels, looking at which involve a climate change component. I'm trying my hand at that at the moment. I'm finding it a lot more difficult than writing popular science, I must admit. But at some point, something may come out. You never know.
And listeners can get a free new short story you've written called Incoming, about climate change and mass migration, at your website at billmaguire.co.uk. As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to add?
Being Vancouver there, obviously, you have got a bit of a seismic risk. We have got the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami problem, which is something which will happen at some point in the future. So although talking in general about people and saying, you know, don't worry too much about these things, clearly, if you live in a zone like that, an earthquake zone, you do need to pay attention to what the authorities are telling you about how to prepare for earthquakes and tsunamis. So just keep safe, really.
Okay, we've been talking with British Professor William Maguire. He's the author of books on extreme global threats and has advised the UK government. And if you can only read one Maguire book, I recommend Waking the Giant, How Climate Change Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. I'll put links to Bill and his work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Bill Maguire, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
No doubt you've heard that fossil fuel emissions are turning the world's oceans more acidic. Scientists are scrambling to find out what that means for our future. There's a new report out based on a meeting of 540 experts from 37 countries held in Monterey, California in September 2012. It was the third symposium on the ocean in a high CO2 world. Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome one of America's top ocean scientists, Dr. Richard Feeley. He's from NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. Hello, Dr. Feeley.
Hello. Glad to be on your show.
Well, it isn't like a more acidic ocean is going to burn our skin when we go swimming or anything, but it can damage sea creatures that depend on calcium for shells. Why should we care about that?
Well, in the seafood industry, many of our calcifying organisms represent about 50% of the total economic value of our seafood, particularly here in the United States, where about $2 billion a year are related to calcifying organisms, such as shrimp, lobster, clams, oysters. In fact, the oyster industry is having a significant number of problems right now because of ocean acidification.
As I read through the report, I became alarmed for our own future as much as small sea creatures, because the symposium agreed oceans are soaking up to 24 million tons of CO2 a day, but that buffer may not keep working as well. Can you explain what's happening with that?
Yes, there's a natural process by which carbon dioxide that's released into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuel, coal, oil, and natural gas. Mankind's been releasing about, as you said, 70 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every day, and about 22 million is absorbed by the oceans. This is a process of air-sea exchange of gases into the oceans, and that ocean uptake has caused a change in the pH, a lowering of the pH. And since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have observed a decrease in the pH, about 0.1 units, which represents a 30% increase in the acidity of the oceans on a global basis.
Our CO2 emissions keep setting new records. If that continues into a worst-case scenario, what happens to the oceans by 2100?
Depending on what CO2 emission scenarios we are looking at, there is a range of scenarios. But the trajectory that mankind is in right now, we would expect to see a increase in atmospheric CO2 out to about 800 parts per million. And associated with that would be about a 0.3 to 0.4 decrease in the overall pH, which would be an increase in the acidity of the oceans of about 100 to 150%.
Some people, as you know, continue to doubt that human carbon emissions really cause climate change, but there is zero doubt in this paper that fossil fuel burning is changing the chemistry of the sea. How can scientists be certain of that?
Oh, well, we have a global ocean carbon observing system throughout the world oceans. They consist of moorings that are deployed. There are, right now, there are 32 moorings throughout the world oceans that have carbon sensors on them. In addition to that, we put CO2 sensors on ships of opportunity that transfer back and forth between continents, and we collect surface ocean data from those ships of opportunity. And we have discrete cruises that measure the water column chemistry from surface to bottom in what was called the International Ghost Ship Program that studies the chemistry of the oceans, say, from Antarctica to Alaska or from Japan to the U.S. These are decade-long cruises, and that allows us to determine the changes in chemistry throughout the water column. So we have very detailed chemical measurements that actually allows us from measurements alone to determine the changes in the CO2 concentrations in the oceans.
So the report also has high confidence that if we reduce emissions, ocean acidification will not be as bad. And will the impact that we're having continue for a long time?
Yes, that's one of the concerns about ocean acidification. The ocean circulation is really quite slow. It takes about 1,500 years or so for the entire circuit from the North Atlantic to the South Atlantic to through the Indian Ocean and back up to the North Pacific. And so consequently, the neutralization of all that CO2 takes a very, very long time. And so as we continue to take up CO2 into the oceans, it will take a longer and longer time for that CO2 to be neutralized. For example, if we have a business-as-usual scenario where the atmospheric concentration would reach about 850 parts per million, it would take well over 10,000 years for the CO2 levels to get back to normal when we shut off those CO2 emissions. Whereas if we cut off CO2 emissions right now, we could see returning to normal within a few hundred years.
When scientists talk about the rate of acidification, the numbers seem quite small. Why does a 0.1 change in pH reflect a big change in the chemistry?
Well, pH is much like the Richter scale. It's actually a logarithmic scale. So a 1 pH unit change is actually a tenfold change in the concentration of the acidity of the oceans. So when we say that it's been a 0.1 pH change since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that's a 30% increase in the hydrogen ion concentration. That's more than anything we've seen over the last 50 million years.
And we shouldn't, as the report says, consider ocean acidification in a vacuum. How does a more acid ocean interact with things like warmer seas or even overfishing?
Many of these processes interact with each other to enhance the acidification effect. For example, coral reefs, when you look at the combined effects of acidification and global warming together, the impacts on corals are much worse because of the combined impact of increasing temperature and increasing acidification than either one of those two effects by themselves. And so from an ecosystem perspective, we would be concerned about how these combined impacts would occur. In a climate change world where the CO2 levels are increasing and the surface temperatures are increasing, the combined impacts on many of our marine ecosystems are more severe.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Marine Lab. Our guest is scientist Dr. Richard Feely. We're talking about making the oceans more acidic by burning fossil fuels. Richard, dead zones are popping up. Some people on the internet are afraid the ocean is dying. What do you think about that?
No, that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is that some species of organisms are highly sensitive to ocean acidification. Other species actually do better in a high CO2 world. But those species that are of importance to mankind for food resources, many of those species, particularly those species that have a calcium carbonate shell or skeleton, they are very, very sensitive to ocean acidification, so we're very concerned about that. When we look at the different species of organisms that are important food sources for mankind, a large portion of those species are affected by ocean acidification. On the other hand, seagrasses and other species of marine plants like cyanobacteria or jellyfish, they do well in a high CO2 world. So what we'd expect to see is significant species shifts in a high CO2 world. And the ramifications of those shifts through the ecosystem are yet to be understood.
Well, you bring that up. The scientists have high confidence in the cause and solution to ocean acidification, but predicting the economic and social costs came with low confidence. Why is that?
Well, what we know for certain is the chemistry of ocean acidification. We know that quite well because the observations are very, very clear and they are consistent with the models. So there's high confidence about the chemistry of ocean acidification. There's also high confidence about the impacts that we would have on some of our fishery species, particularly clams and oysters, where the experimental evidence is very, very clear. And with respect to oysters, for example, we know that there is an economic impact right now from the experiences we've had on the west coast of North America and California, Washington, Oregon, which are already seeing impacts of ocean acidification on their industries. The extension of that kind of effort and that kind of understanding to the global oceans is not as clear yet. And so we have a medium confidence on those kinds of economic impacts to this state.
You know, I've interviewed scientists who believe human geoengineering is needed to save the Arctic ice, perhaps by spraying sulfur aerosols. How would that affect the problem of ocean acidification?
Most of those geoengineering approaches address the cooling of the atmosphere. They don't address the amount of carbon dioxide that would be taken up by the oceans. So by neglecting the root cause of climate change, CO2, and its uptake in the oceans, most of those geoengineering approaches will not have any helpful impact on ocean acidification. And in some cases, for example, with iron fertilization and other approaches like that, it may actually enhance the acidification of the oceans. So there's a lot of research that has yet to be done to address what the overall impact would be.
Is there a safe level of ocean acidification? And second question, is there a tipping point where ecosystems will not recover?
Well, what we have learned so far is that each species of organism has a mechanism to either respond to acidification in a very negative way, in which we have tipping points for those organisms. For example, for oyster larvae, there's a fairly clear tipping point for the Pacific oyster. But other organisms have an ability to adapt to these changes, so the tipping points would be quite different. So we're faced with the situation of looking at this from one organism to the next to understand the responses and the adaptability of those organisms to acidification. And the research on adaptation is just getting started over the last 2 or 3 years, so we have a lot to learn about that process.
To me, changing the chemistry of the ocean seems like a huge step. Are scientists rallying around the need to find out more about this, and are national governments paying attention?
Yes, very much so. Within the United States, for example, there was a Federal Ocean Acidification Research and Monitoring Act of 2009 that focused 8 federal agencies to work together on ocean acidification. So there's a national program on ocean acidification. And at the same time, we have been working internationally through the efforts of the International Ocean Acidification Coordination Center in Monaco to coordinate the activities of at least right now 29 nations working to develop an ocean acidification observing system at the international level and developing research plans and priorities in order to coordinate all our efforts at the international level.
Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know?
When I give my presentations on ocean acidification, I always remind them that we as human beings have a very significant decision to make, and that's how we continue to use fossil fuels for energy and the implications of that for the health and welfare of our natural ecosystems. Decisions that we make over the next 30 to 50 years represents a change in the chemistry of the oceans that will be with us for hundreds of thousands to millions of years. So these are very, very important decisions that we need to make, and they have very serious implications for our marine ecosystems.
Our guest has been Dr. Richard Feely from NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. He's one of the authors of an international report called Ocean Acidification, Summary for Policymakers, Third Symposium on the Ocean in a High CO2 World. Find links to that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Richard Feely, thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Be sure to tune in next week as we investigate another side of the climate crisis.
Thank you for listening and caring about our world.